Why does Rice play Texas? We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
I was always a dreamer. I always saw a life beyond the life that I had as a child.
It was like a big flashing light. This is what you're supposed to do.
Everybody poo-pooed the idea. Network said it couldn't be done.
You're in that zone, and it's that out-of-body experience where it just, everything clicks.
Sometimes you have those dark moments. I was so depressed when I got fired.
I was so mad.
People don't need to be afraid to fail. And again, that's where you learn. You shouldn't be afraid of adversity. You know, that is the thing that makes you strong.
This is Jerry Levias.
This is Jody Markell.
This is Chi Young.
This is Dick Vitale, and you're listening to American Achievers.
Welcome to American Achievers, the podcast that celebrates ambition, commitment to excellence, risk-taking, and tenacity on the road to success. I'm Keith Dunovant. Some of my guests are world-famous. Some are rather obscure. Our weekly lineup includes entrepreneurs, athletes, military heroes, civic leaders, artists, and media figures. What they all have in common is a sense of undeniable purpose and an intriguing story that reflects the power of the American dream. A ship in port is safe, but that is not the purpose of a ship. The familiar quote from long ago strikes to the heart of the American experience. As a nation of pioneers and strivers, descendants of proud, strong, hopeful people who once crossed the hostile wilderness in covered wagons, it is in our nature to look toward the horizon and extend the frontier, to risk in order to achieve something meaningful. Retired Air Force Colonel Joe Kittinger felt this impulse deep in his soul. Kittinger, who died in 2022 at the age of 94, served his country as a fighter pilot and was tortured as a prisoner of war in Vietnam. He will forever be remembered for his pioneering high-altitude balloon flights of the 1950s and early 60s, when he repeatedly put his life on the line to gain knowledge that would prove critical in the early days of the American space program. The year before Alan Shepard's historic suborbital flight, Kittinger flew to the edge of space, jumped out of his craft, and lived, establishing a record that would last for more than half a century. Here's part one of my interview with Joe Kittinger. Joe, welcome. Thanks for being with us today.
Nice to be with you, Keith.
You were born in 1928 in Florida before two things that would dramatically transform the state: air conditioning and Walt Disney. What was it like growing up in Florida in those days?
Well, there was one other thing. They didn't spray from mosquitoes. There was a lot of mosquitoes here in Florida. The air conditioning and the mosquitoes control is what made the Florida the population it has today. And of course, being a Disney World, Universal Sea World conglomerate for tourists, we have, I guess, 50 million tourists a year to come here through the Orlando area. So that was the significant events that happened in this area. I was in the Boy Scouts, and I did a lot of camping and fishing and hunting, and it was just a beautiful, beautiful place to grow up in. Orlando had a population of about 30,000. It was just a small little village, and 90% of all the citrus was grown within 90 miles of Orlando. There was only one industry, and that was citrus. And it was a lovely place to grow up. And I was so fortunate because I love the outside. I love the outdoors and hunting and fishing. And this is a mecca for that.
What did you learn from your mother and father?
My mother and father went out of their way to make certain that I would not take care of myself. They were determined to make certain that I grew up with the attitude that I can take care of myself any place. And that really helped me throughout my life because I had a very loving mother and father that they were only resident in my growing up with the right objectives and the right principles. And I was just a very fortunate young man to have a wonderful, loving mother and father that I did.
You're talking about parents who fostered a sense of independence.
Absolutely.
That's foreign to many in today's generation.
Yeah, I know. And that's sad because of there's a wimp population because of the fact that they're dependent upon other people that they can't take care of themselves. And my mother and father were very adamant to make certain that, that I could take care of myself and that that I had the ability to get out and in the open and camping, hunting, fishing. So I was just very fortunate. And I think today, with the advent of television and all the video games and everything, kids stay inside too much. They'll get outside and kick rocks and enjoy the great outdoors and not get welded to the television and their games and stuff that keep them inside. They're missing a whole beautiful part of life by not participating in the outdoors. And I really believe in the Boy Scouts. Now, of course, the Girl Scouts are part of the Boy Scout movement because it teaches the right lessons, the right principles. It teaches you to take care of yourself and to be able to camp and hunt, fish. And I'd say that scouting is one of the great, great things that a child can be introduced to during the growing up phase because it teaches all the right things about God and country and taking care of yourself.
Do you think that's something we've lost as a country?
I think we have. I think we've lost it. I think it's because of the sophistication that we have. There's television and television games and board games and stuff that keeps kids inside. They should be outside. They should be enjoying the outside and be able to take care of themselves and enjoy nature. And we've lost it. We're losing that. And I think it certainly takes away from the character of our country because of the lack of the right principles of God and country and the outdoors.
You like to race speedboats as a young man. What was it that turned you on about that?
Well, once again, being outside, and it was exciting, racing boats. And I started when I was about 14. And I just thoroughly enjoyed it. It was an adventure. It was something that I was doing did myself. I had an awful lot of fun doing it. But the point is that I was outside in nature, taking advantage of the environment that I was growing up in.
And at some point, you became captivated by flight. Can you pinpoint that moment?
Well, as I always, from the very beginning of my life, I thought about being an aviator. That was my goal, was to be a pilot from the very beginning. And I built airplanes and read everything I could and there wasn't any doubt in my mind. That was my goal, was to be an aviator, a fighter pilot. And I didn't think about any other objective. I had one goal, and I worked toward that goal.
What do you remember about your first solo flight at age 17?
Yep. Of course, that was an exciting moment in my life. And the beginning of my aviation, actually getting off the ground in an airplane. And it was just as exciting and as fulfilling as I had anticipated and dreamed about. And it just confirmed that I was going to keep working hard to get in, be a fighter pilot. As soon as I graduated from high school, I went down to the recruiting office and I said, I want to join the Air Force. And the guy said, well, you have to have 2 years of college in order to be eligible. So I said, okay, I'll be back. So he said, well, you can join the enlisted corps and put in for pilot training. I said, no, I want to go the way that you normally go, because if I didn't get accepted, I'd still be in the Air Force as an enlisted man. And I would miss my goal of being a pilot. So I'll see you. I'm going to college. And as soon as I get 2 years, I'll be back. And that's exactly what happened. As soon as I got 2 years of college, University of Florida, I went back and applied for the pilot training.
Were you just itching for those 2 years to get in the air?
Oh, yes. That was my only goal. And I just dedicated myself to do the best I could do at college. And just wait until I could get those two years out of the way so I could join the Air Force.
Pretty soon, you wind up stationed in post-war West Germany, flying the F-84, one of the first jet fighters. Now, the F-84 had a checkered history. Why?
Well, it was the first generation. It was the first generation jet, really. The F-80 was the first one, but this was really the first generation airplane. There was some engine growing problems with the airplane, but there was not that many people killed. And we had a good ejection system, and we lost a lot of airplanes, but we did lose a lot of pilots.
Who was Dr. John Stapp?
Well, first of all, it was 1963, Keith, when I went from Germany to Holland Air Force Base in New Mexico. And I was assigned to the fighter test section. And what an exciting job that was. I flew 11 different airplanes at one time. I flew 7 days a week. It was just the ultimate for a fighter pilot. But then I met Dr. Stapp, and I met him through, one day our commander called us, all the fighter pilots in, test pilots, and said, Dr. Stapp is working on space projects, and everybody started laughing about space, because back in those days, space was Buck Rogers and something we never thought we'd ever go into space. So everybody kind of chuckled, and he said, anyway, Dr. Stapp thinks we're going to go into space, and he's got a project that he's starting, and he wants to volunteer a pilot. So I immediately put my hand up, and I looked around, and I was the only person that volunteered. What have I done here? So anyway, my boss says, go over and report to Dr. Stapp. So that's how I met him. I walked over and I introduced myself. I said, sir, I'm your project pilot. And he said, well, we're going to go into space, and there's certain knowledge that we need that we don't have, and I'm working on it. And he said, for example, we don't know if man can survive zero gravity, which there will be when they're in orbit. So one of your first projects is going to be a zero gravity project. And I said, well, how do we do that? He said, well, you'll go up in a T-33 jet with a man in the back seat, and we do various experiments and take physiological measurements and see if a man really can stand the rigors of zero gravity. So that was really the beginning of my association with Dr. Stapp. And I made about 1,000 of those parabolic trajectories with different people in the back seat. And we determined that man could survive zero gravity. Some people got nauseated, but they got over it with certain medicines. But that was my first introduction to Dr. Stapp, was to go into space.
Set the scene here for us, Joe, because you're talking about 4 years before Sputnik.
Nobody ever thought we were going to go into space. It was an alien thought, except one guy that was a visionary, and that was Dr. Stapp. He was a visionary. He knew we were going to space, and there was certain information and knowledge that we needed to prepare for that, and that's what I became involved with him. And then one day he said, you know, when the man goes up into space, it's going to be in a very small vehicle. We have to develop the life support systems, the communications, the physiological monitoring, the selection process for the astronauts. And he said, I want to start a program called Man High, and I'm looking for a volunteer. And I said, sir, I'm a volunteer. And he said, well, you're just the man we want, because I want a test pilot to make the first flight.
You're talking about something that was very dangerous. What was it inside you that made you want to take that risk?
Well, first of all, I felt like I could take care of myself. Second of all, I was a very good pilot, and I wasn't going to do something that had an inordinate risk. I was going to make certain that I had a chance for survival in whatever I did. And I always did it that way. I loved life. Love living, and I would never undertake something that there was no chance of survival. So even though it was something that had never been done before, I had confidence in myself that I was going to do the due diligence to make certain that I could survive.
You're listening to American Achievers. Stay tuned for more conversation. What was the objective of Man High?
Well, the purpose was to develop a small capsule that we could put on top of a rocket and shoot into space. And we had to develop the life support systems, the physiological monitoring systems, so we could see how man's doing in space, communications, selection process. There was a whole list of items that we didn't know, we didn't have any answers to, that we needed before we could go into space. And so that was the purpose of it, was to the preliminary studies and to define the capsule, life support system, and so forth, that we could put on top of a rocket and send a man into space. So it was really the first spacecraft. It was the prototype for the first spacecraft. And the knowledge that we gained and the information that we obtained, NASA used it later on when they started the Mercury program. So the Manhattan program was a lead into the space program. And it was because of the brilliance of Dr. Stapp, knowing that the things that we really needed to concentrate on in order to prepare for our space voyage.
Tell me more about Dr. Stapp.
He was very dedicated. He was a person who worked 28 hours a day, 8 days a week, on one goal, and that's space. And he was also working on restraint devices. He was the one who really that was responsible for the lap belt in automobiles as part of his research that he did. At that time, Keith, they were losing more people in automobile crashes than we were in airplane crashes. So Dr. Stapp started a program of restraint and lap belts and shoulder harnesses that have saved millions of lives. And he was the one that started it at Edwards Air Force Base when he was stationed there. And then when he came to Holloman, he continued it. And the culmination of his research was he did 640 miles an hour on a sled and stopped at just a few feet and pulled minus 41 G's. And because on reentry, you were going to have that problem. And of course, it also had to do with crash protection for vehicles and airplanes. So he not only was involved with space, he was involved with flat belts, seat belts, and so forth. But he was just a brilliant man, a brilliant scientist that dedicated his life to mankind and to the coming space age.
And what was it about your makeup that made you write for that project?
The opportunity to do something I've never done before. The opportunity to go into an area that was unique. I was just thrilled to death that I was in that opportunity to work with a brilliant man like this and to be able to do something that's never been done before in an exciting new world of challenges that that I was having the opportunity to be a part of. And I felt I was the luckiest guy in the whole world to have that opportunity with Dr. Stapp on the program.
So the day of the first flight of Manhigh, what's going through your mind?
Well, first of all, you have to imagine this capsule I was in was only 3 feet across and 7 feet high. I could only sit down. You couldn't stand up. You couldn't do anything except just sit down. Very small area. And they put me in there about midnight and put me, rolled the gondola into a pickup truck. And we drove 12 miles out to an airfield. So it was kind of different than the way we ended up with NASA with all their fabulous vehicles to transport the astronauts out to the launch site. In my case, I was on the back end of a pickup truck. But in any event, we went out to a little airfield called South St. Paul, Minnesota. And just before sunup, they started inflating the balloon. And I'm inside just waiting. We launch at about 6:30 in the morning. And away we go. And about three-quarters of the way up, I suddenly noticed that my oxygen system was not working properly. I mean, we didn't have the money that we could go into an altitude chamber before the flight and check out the equipment. That would have been the smart thing to do, but we just didn't have the money to do it with. And so I was going up into an environment that had never been tested in an altitude chamber, which was because of lack of funds. So anyway, I suddenly discovered that I was using oxygen at a much higher rate than I should have been, and that I was going to be running out of oxygen pretty quick. So the balloon was, the sun was coming up, it was heating up the gas, and I was ascending rather rapidly. And I ended up at about 97,000 feet at the top. And I would valve the open a valve, let the gas out. But when the valve closed, the gas would heat up from the sun. So it was taking me quite a while to get the balloon to start down. And the other problem was I had a very, very limited amount of ballast because we wanted to go as high as we could go. And that was a function of the weight of the total system. So I had very little ballast to stop the descent rate. So I had to be very careful the rate that I was coming down, because if I was coming down too fast, I didn't have the means to stop it because of the lack of ballast. So I was working to get the balloon to come down. But I did it very slowly and methodically because of the ballast challenge. So suddenly one of the doctors on the ground called up and said, because they could see how much oxygen I had, they knew it was low and critical. And also just had to take off, I found out that my radio wasn't working. And my only communication was with transmit was Morse code. And I could receive on a receiver, but to transmit, I had to use the Morse code. And I wasn't very good at Morse code, and I was very slow at it. So, and in any event, the communications was with me transmitting to them the problem, and then them talking to me on the radio, I could hear them. So I'm up there, and when I had discovered the problem, I told them about it. And they made me become concerned, so I sent back my Morse code, no sweat. And so in the event, I'm finally at that altitude. I've been working for about half an hour or so to get down, starting down. So So this doctor on the ground calls me and said, come down immediately. That's an order. Come down immediately. And I was kind of ticked off because I've been working for an hour to come down. And I wasn't going to do what he said because he wasn't up there and it wasn't his rear end, it was mine. So he said, come down immediately. In a very demanding fashion. And as I said, I was kind of ticked off because I'd been working to do that for an hour. So I tapped back to him, come up and get me. Well, that really drove him nuts. He said he's got space psychoses. There was a theory that when you went into space that you would get where you didn't want to come back to Earth, which was ridiculous, particularly for a fighter pilot.
You were just another defiant test pilot, weren't you?
Yeah, so I just said, come up and get me. And that really threw them off. They really got concerned. And then finally, Dr. Stapp gets on the radio and he said, Joe, are you coming down? I said, yes, sir, I'm working on it. I'll be down there after a while. He said, I'll still worry about it. But that's how the come up and get me statement came out and why it came out.
Of course, that became the title of your book, Come Up and Get Me, which I recommend. Terrific read. What did that moment say about you?
I knew that I had difficulty. I was working to come down, but I was going to do it in a methodical, safe manner. And because, you know, it was me, and I was by myself, and I was responsible for what happened. And I wasn't going to listen to them because they weren't in the position that I was in. And they had not been working for an hour trying to get down. And it finally started coming down. And I made a perfect landing, as a matter of fact, in a little stream. And I made an absolutely perfect landing because I methodically did the valving and didn't hit the panic button to get down too fast because of the limited ballast.
You completed Project Manhai, which gained all this practical knowledge just before NASA was created. But you weren't finished pushing to the edge of space. What happened next?
Well, let me tell you that there's a poet by the name of Ernest Gaughan. And he said, run if you can, hide if you must. You are the quarry. Fate is a hunter. And in all of our lives, fate is a hunter. Everything that ever happens in our lives is because of fate. You get to a crossroads in your career. You go either left or right. That's fate, which way you go. And about in September of 57, I was flying an F-100 on takeoff. It caught on fire. And I declared an emergency, and I was coming around to make a landing. And the airplane stick came back in my lap. I had no control of the airplane. The airplane stalled out. And I had to eject at 800 feet, very low altitude in those days. And I took one swing, hit the ground, and I just had my life saved by ejection system. Well, as fate would have it, about a week later, Dr. Stapp called me into his office. And he said, Captain, he says, I'm being transferred to Dayton, Ohio, to be the chief of the air med lab there. And I'm offering you an opportunity to go there and work on escape systems. Well, I just have my rear end saved by an ejection seat. So I, of course, said, well, I would be delighted, Dr. Stapp. And he said, and we can also continue our work on space challenges. So that's how I went from being a fighter pilot, experimental test pilot at Holloman, to the Air Med Lab at Dayton, Ohio, where Dr. Stapp was the chief of the air med lab there. It was fate. If I hadn't ejected a week before, I'm not positive I would have gone because I was having so much fun at Holloman, flying all these wonderful airplanes, being an experimental test pilot. Holloman was just a wonderful place for a fighter pilot to be in. And the only reason I went was because of fate. The week before, I had my life saved by an ejection system.
Thanks to Elaine McGibney and all the good folks at Boutwell Studios for all the TLC required to bring this podcast to life, and audio engineers Joe Beeman and Jonathan W. Hickman. Remember, everyone has a special talent. You just need to identify it, cultivate it, and be willing to pay the price. You too can become an American Achiever.